Welcome to Cider Chat. In this episode, we're speaking with Elizabeth Ryan of Hudson Valley Farmhouse Cider in New York State, which is an absolute treat because she is basically a walking encyclopedia of this region, is a lifetime farmer, has a degree from Cornell University in pomology, and is the person behind many of the farm markets in the area. And not to mention, she makes outstanding cider. Hello, my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. If you are new to this here podcast, well, do know that there is a ton of episodes archived at ciderchat.com and also at all the podcast directory apps where you could download and listen as you please to over 200, and now including this one, 87 episodes. And to all of you who are regular listeners of this here podcast who download it perhaps at ciderchat.com or any one of the podcast app directories out there on the World Wide Web, what a magnificent ride we've been on. It's a little bit much to take in for me, so I'm going to keep on moving on here. And when I return, we have a little bit of news coming in from Germany, a really cool project with pears.
Walking through the orchards.
By the way, Ciderville, if you're noticing that my audio is a little bit different, well, you're right, because I am still recording remotely. And this should be my last recording like that for a little while, because I'll be back in my home port of Ciderville shortly. But in the meanwhile, I'm just going to like be playing a little bit of the waves in the background. You hear all those people laughing. That's a packed beach in California, and I feel pretty safe being out there. Of course, with the pandemic, you know, it's just a crazy world. But I just want to say, please stay safe, because nothing felt better to me than seeing so many people having fun, people smiling at each other. I miss that. I want to go to cider festivals. The Ross Cider Fest took place this past weekend, and an amazing event. I would have loved to have gone. And of course, the first ever kickoff event for the New England Museum of Apples and Cider, a project that I'm part of, also took place in my special spot of Ciderville, known as Massachusetts. I had to miss that because I had some family duties, but you know, wow, so many great events happening. I think I see that Jimmy Carbone, our New York Dynamo beer dude, who's now a cider dude, is doing another cider feast event coming up here in September. Festivals are happening, but not all can be happening. And I miss it so much. Anyways, so we're going to go now to a little bit on what's happening in Germany. And this is a project that was spearheaded by our friend Barry Masterson of Kilterreiter Cider. He was in episode 251, let me see what the name of that was, 251, Irish Expat in Germany, Kilterreiter Cider, makes outstanding cider and perry, and this particular project is all about perry pears. The whole idea is to preserve different varieties in the region, and so he has kind of like a crowdfunding scene going on, where you could sponsor a tree and sponsor a meadow. And he's been getting a really good reply. He hasn't met his full amount that he's going for. But how cool would it be to sponsor a tree? And you could even say what pear tree you would like planted, or they will pick it for you. And the idea here is to get some land and to preserve it for eternity, I guess. You know, infinity. For perry pears, because they are old buggers. I mean, they live a really long time, and yet there's all these magnificent perry pear trees in Germany that are always under threat. Not just Germany, but worldwide, they're always under threat of development. So there's going to be a link in the show notes to this. It's basically Kilterreiter Cider Perry Pear Project. If you Google it, you might be able to find it. But there's a couple of the little dots and stuff. So I will put the link in the show notes for this here episode 287. Wonderful project, Barry. I love it. and tip of the glass to you and little pup Anu. Up next is our featured conversation with Elizabeth Ryan of Hudson Valley Farmhouse Cider in New York State. My stop with Elizabeth was the first on my tour this summer to New York and Pennsylvania cideries, and it was such a pleasure hanging out with her. Actually, the last time I saw her was on Valentine's Day in 2020. We had met up in France. We were both attending Cider Expo. And of course, what do you do on Valentine's Day when you're not with your honey? Well, you seek out another friendly cider maker and hang out. And what a lovely time with her. As I've gotten to know Elizabeth over the past couple years, as I've been reaching out beyond my own special borders of Ciderville, it's just been outstanding to get a bit of her story. And she's been on my radar for quite a while. But she has a lot to give, and as such, I really needed to have a deep dive hanging out with her, because Elizabeth is not one to really talk about herself or what she's doing at Hudson Valley Farmhouse Cider. She has so many stories with epic people, both in the U.S. and worldwide, that she's kind of bubbling over with info. So I needed to hang out with her a bit to try to bring it back to Elizabeth and her story. And that's where we're going to start, a bit about her family's history, giving you the roots of her beginnings into farming and where it has taken her.
My mother's the oldest of 10 from Iowa. They came from the Alsace and from Bohemia, and they went to Iowa in 1875, and they broke the sod, and they acquired 10 farms, one for each child. My family used to say, even the girls.
Wow.
And my great-great-great planted an orchard, and I did not know this for a very long time. And when I was, you know, when I started getting farms and growing fruit, my mother would say to me, often sort of she would recite off these apples that she had really loved, and they used to go to this decrepit old farm, the original, they called it the South Place, and the South Place had the old orchard, and it was this sort of iconic place, and they grew a lot of Jonathans and Whitneys, and my mother was in love with Whitneys, and Whitney now in our community is having a renaissance, but you know, even studying pomology, it was like I never heard of a Whitney. And at one point I said to my mother, but Mom, Whitneys are crab apples. And she's like, I know, but they're the best.
Wow.
So that's just kind of one of those funny threads, you know, where you keep, you know, these things kind of evolve. So I never intended to be a farmer. I spent every summer on the farm. It was traditional and gender defined, and it was big, and I watched that family farm grow. It's now 2,400 acres of corn and 1,200 acres of soy.
Still in the family.
Still in the family. In fact, my very crusty, difficult old uncle wrote into his will, and no one knew this, that the farm could never be sold out of the family. I don't even know if that's legal. When they read his will, everybody was like, what? Yeah. You know, because Uncle Bill was not, and this is this interesting paradox in agriculture, right? Of the kind of people that are just very taciturn and, you know, you've met you in your travels, and yet they hold the love and the romance and the passion, and how that gets expressed. And it's really, you know, counterintuitive sometimes.
I think it's kind of cool that he did that in a way. I'm sure it's a pain in the butt.
I was thrilled.
But, you know,
it's
cool.
So,
and can I just ask?
Yeah.
So that farm is primarily what kind of farm is
that
it?
That is corn and soy now.
Okay.
It was a very diversified family farm. My mother grew up there, dirt poor during the Depression. people lost farms. She wore flour sacks, literally. Mm-hmm. I have some wonderful anecdotes from her, though, about fighting with her sister that the flour companies, we're already getting a little off track, but the flour companies would print dresses right on the sacks. And they would fight with their mother over, you know, which
patterns,
which one to get. Yeah. You know, I want the pink one. I want the blue one. But mom left, and she had a very negative view of the farm. She married my dad, and you know, but my folks took us out there, and it was, you know, very otherworldly. It was still, there were still 20 people for lunch on the farm every day. It was still very labor intensive. My uncles were still home. There was lots of food. Everything was from scratch. If you my grandfather, you know, used to take us out and say, "We're gonna have chicken. Well, which one do you want, kids? Go get them. Go get them. Go get them. Wow. We need 10 of them. Go get them."
Right.
You know, and hand somebody the axe, and you know. So I grew up in this way that I didn't really understand was kind of different. Mm-hmm. You know, it was. I feel very, very lucky, but it was also a very traditional, gender-defined world. Not maybe philosophically, but as a practical matter, you know, there was a massive amount of cooking. We would shuck 100 ears of corn for dinner. We'd everybody would eat 3 or 4 of them. It was just, everything was from scratch. Store-bought was a bad word. You know, they'd come through the Depression, and they had old world roots. I don't think they ever made hard cider, but they, you know, made homemade wine and dandelion wine, and, you know, they were great fermenters and picklers and, you know, the whole thing. But eventually, I ended up at Cornell, and I went to Cornell to study engineering, physics, actually. And I was there for a year. I quickly discovered that would not be my path in life. And I discovered the ag school, and I literally called my grandfather. I mean, this is almost embarrassing, the story, and said, "Grandpa, you know, did you know you can study agriculture in college?" And he said, "You can't learn how to farm from a book, girly." And he was right, but that was like a universe. You know, we've all had those moments. Yeah. A universe opened up to me, and the Vietnam War was still raging. I was an activist. I was sort of trying to figure it out. That war, as we know, eventually ended. My generation, who came of age in that period, I think that shaped us in a lot of ways. And I wanted to be someone who made the world a better place, who grew things, who didn't destroy things, who celebrated goodness in life. And when I took a slight detour, I started studying policy. I couldn't understand why farms like my family farm, and I watched the farm transition from being this very diversified family farm to being this corn monoculture, spray the shit out of everything, can't drink your own water, and they still couldn't make money. I mean, I spent all those summers in Iowa around the kitchen table listening to the price of corn, and everything turned on, you know, a penny. And they were very stressed, and they borrowed more and more money. I mean, it's a bust or boom cycle, and it's not just the weather, it's the commodity pricing. And I was like, they're the richest farmland, you know, in America, and such a degradation of so many things. So I knew just intuitively there had to be a better way. There had to be a better way. And when I hit Cornell, you know, there was a small group of people who were asking really hard, big questions about our food system, who controls it, how we grow things, monopoly capitalism, why is our soil blowing away? And I got very interested in policy. I studied ag policy for 2 years.
At Cornell.
That was a very fascinating, and I learned a lot. And I got involved with an accountability study of Cornell called Failing the People. Failing the People. A group of students who had had some money from Jim Hightower, the Agribusiness Accountability Project, and had published a 500-page piece of work looking at it was a criticism of Cornell for being too big, too corporate, for losing track of their mission to serve the people. And it was provocative. It was controversial, extremely. And I ended up becoming kind of an activist and was, you know, young. I was very young. And some folks in Washington who were interested in the same questions. And this was a small community of people who thought that food was such an important issue, whether it was community gardens or farm worker issues. But we were a very small club, so to speak. And this little organization that was wanted to revolutionize the food system invited me to come and speak. They were training community organizers to work on food and agriculture in New England. A group of students out of Amherst who were very progressive. Every year, Harry Chapin, the late great Harry Chapin, would come and do a concert. And all of the funding for his concert would be given to this little organization to train community organizers in five states to be food and agriculture activists. And we had a particular interest in local agriculture and farmers markets. And this was in 1975. Imagine, and I was invited to speak. I had a lot of passion. I was maybe even a little more to the left than I am now. You know, it's easy when you're 20 years old and you think you know everything. And they kicked off, they did a seminar for a week on Helen and Scott Nearing's farm. Elliot Coleman was the farm manager. And they wanted to talk about how to reform the land-grant college complex. And I came and spoke, and they told me, we're hiring a director. You should interview for the job. And I went to Washington, and I interviewed for the job, and they offered me the job, and I left Cornell, and I moved to Washington. That was in 1977, I think, and took this really extraordinary job running this activist project. We had a project in New England, and we had a project in the South, working with all kinds of communities, different, really different projects. And I did a lot of work on Capitol Hill, and we had a wonderful board. Robert Rodale was on our board, and Harry Chapin was on our board, and Jim Hightower was on our board. I mean, it was like, but we were such, and there was a guy that came to Washington named Pat Mooney from Canada, and he had written a book against the patenting of seeds. And he came to Washington and he said, if we let this happen, all these terrible things will happen. And we lobbied very strongly against the patenting of seed, but we published a book on how to bring local food, in 1975, local food into your college food system, how to connect with farmers, how to set up farmers markets, how to work with communities, you know, immigrant farmers and communities of color. And so I did that for a couple of years. Jimmy Carter was president. It was an amazing time to be in Washington. And we were a grain of sand on the beach. I mean, we were the issues that we were so fierce about at that time. There wasn't even organic legislation. The O word wasn't even out there. So in that way, it was really interesting. And I pretty quickly decided I want to be a farmer. I mean, I want to farm. If I'm going to do this work, I don't want to be in Washington. I don't want to go to law school. I don't want to be a lobbyist. I don't want to. I need to go back to Cornell and finish my degree and farm for a living And if I work, I want to work from the place where I have that, you know, perspective. Mm-hmm. Because you do feel sometimes a lot of, you see how contorted the process and the wheeling and dealing. I mean, we were like in the back room sometimes.
It's
and
politics.
Just the insanity
food
of Washington.
Yeah.
And I understand it. I still, when people need help, I still do quite a bit. I've in the subsequent 30 or whatever, 40 years, you know, I say to people, I'm still really good at that. And if you need me, I'll go to, you know, I've worked with Hillary Clinton and worked with when she was, you know, our senator and many, many others. So, you know, I understand the legislative process. I think I'll put it that simply.
Yeah.
And I still bring passion into it. But I knew I didn't want to do that. So I went back to Cornell. I was a little older than everybody
so
else.
You hadn't, so let me just pause here. So you hadn't completed your degree in pathology?
Fuck no. Pardon? Okay. Am I allowed to say that?
And I'm just kind of curious. At Cornell, Ian wasn't there yet. This is like
pre-Ian. Big like, time. I think I sat in when they hired him.
Wow.
He came as grad student the year I graduated, and he came, and I had actually taught a graduate level seminar, even though I was an undergrad in the pomology department, called Rethinking the Orchard Paradigm, strategies for, you know, sustainable agriculture. And we were looking at some really cutting edge non-chemical ways to control fire blight, you know, insect management, a really, really advanced IPM. And the other thing that had happened, so I went back to Cornell, I fell down the rabbit hole, and I was like, I just want to grow grapes. I want to grow fruit. You know, I want to ferment things. That's what I want to do with my life.
Had
I want to live in the Garden of Eden.
Had you been involved at a cider at any point at this point?
No. It was kind of, it was so, I mean, this was the 70s, and it was like Boone's Farm apple wine. I mean, that's
exactly.
There was so little cider, and it was so not in the vocabulary, in the vernacular at all. And so, no. So, you know, take, you know, agronomy and pomology, and I pretty much had to start from scratch, plant pathology, and I still, you know, I actually took, you know, a few little ancillary, the reproductive anatomy and physiology of farm animals, a very fun class. And you know, I just fell in love with it. I was just like down. And what I really wanted to do was be, was grow grapes, grow heirloom varieties, ferment. And even
grapes.
Though...
Well, can you say why? Why was it grapes
so,
that
well,
caught your
so
passion?
So, cider was just not...
Landscape.
Even though, in fact, I didn't even want to grow apples. I was kind of well known for saying, I want to grow grapes. You know, I want to live in France. I want to, you know, I want to go to California. I want to be part of this new, young, you know, viticulture people that are bringing flavor out and making these incredible things. And I don't want to filter things.
And suddenly a woman walks in with a chicken under both arms. And I'm going to leave this conversation in here so you could get a sense of Elizabeth's pace on a daily basis and the kind of people that have been informing her entire life.
Show me the chickens. This is a typical moment. Oh, my God. Are they here now?
What?
Did you bring them?
No.
They were in your car?
No, I just caught them. They were over there where the chickens used to be. And then I didn't catch them when we were moving chickens over to there.
Oh, okay.
So they were wild chickens for a few days.
How did you catch them? I mean, that's not easy.
I put out some food. And I put out food every day or two for a couple of days.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I went there and I didn't see them. I thought they weren't coming. And then decided to come and have a little snacky
food. Polly is a very smart person, and she has a PhD. And so we're open on all of the farms to Polly. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Nice meeting you.
To anyone who has an idea, and we almost never say no. So a couple of years ago, Polly came to us
with chickens.
And, with something more interesting than chickens. She's been raising and breeding a number of very rare, unusual French and other kinds of ducks and geese. And so all kinds of poulet de Brest, she's been breeding out all these rare heirloom. And then she was producing, with her husband, a line of Applewood smoked duck breast, and we were working with her on all of this.
Which goes very well with cider.
Oh my God, we've had some memorable meals here. Anyways.
So, and
she still has, she's got the run of the farm, as do oh so many other people. You never know who's going to roll
I
in.
Love that. Shows but, up with two chickens
exactly
in a hand.
Right.
Perfect.
So, anyway, we were talking a little bit about Cornell. So I was really intrigued by cider. And there was one kind of eccentric guy, and I was working at the Cornell Orchards. I mean, you know, it's all about apples.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't fermenting.
No.
Well, mostly, you know, when you're a student, you're in Ithaca,
mm-hmm,
and you are studying there, and Geneva is research, so there are no classes there.
I see.
And at the time that I was there, there were still, I think, 50 or 60 PhD research scientists in Geneva. Geneva was the big Long Ashton, you know, think tank.
Yeah. If you haven't noticed by now, talking to Elizabeth is kind of like trying to herd cats. So at this point, I asked her pretty directly, what informed you to go into cider making? And it all came down to one very specific person.
Lester Funk.
Lester Funk.
Lester Funk. The name perhaps lives on in infamy. And so Lester Funk was a food scientist who, there had been something that happened, but he wrote a little pamphlet that I still have somewhere. He's very well known in the Ithaca area. He's long gone.
That's a great name.
Oh my God, you can't make that up.
No.
Called, you know, The Joy of the Apple, or, you know, something like that. This little self-published, and it was about making vinegar and hard cider. And I knew him. He was also a cheese fanatic, of course. And he was into, you know, wild fermentations and all this stuff. And so and we were part of this crazy circle. I was involved with this group called New World Agriculture that was looking at collaborative research where you would look at insects and plant-insect interactions and plant-soil interactions and old varieties and, you know, very cutting-edge kind of sustainable eco-farming stuff. Carl Sagan was our sponsor, a research collective of 25 students who wanted to really rethink. Not many of them have gone on to become very prominent in sustainable ag stuff. They're scattered all over the country. So Lester Funk, this is actually a very funny story that I haven't told in a really long time. And my then boyfriend, and we had this little green VW bug. And at the end of the year, we were living off the grid in Newfield, New York, completely off the grid, in a log cabin in the woods, trying to have an authentic life, trying to be part of the solution and not part of the problem, and kind of, you know, living the dream. And Lester Funk said to us, you know, I went to Lester and I'm like, I want to make hard cider. Because he was like the guy who wrote this weird little book, like you know.
Was this just curiosity? I want to make hard cider. Like, I want to make a batch.
I was studying pomology, and so I went to him, and he said, "Well, first you need a barrel, a really good barrel." And we were like, "Okay, where are we going to get, you know, a barrel?" And he had this little like winemaking store. And he was like, well, you have to go to the barrel auctions. Would you like to go to the barrel auctions with me? I go every year. I was like, I'd love to go to the barrel auctions, but I don't think I can. And he goes, well, I'll go to the barrel auctions, you know, in Kentucky, and I'll get a really good, I'll bring back, he brought back truckloads of barrels to resell. So he got us a barrel.
A bourbon barrel.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I mean, anything you do in a bourbon barrel, as we know, becomes very delicious. And we could have a whole debate about is it the bourbon, is it the cider, is it all of it? I mean, we actually do quite a bit. We should crack open some bourbon barrel aged cider right now, maybe.
Yeah.
If you want to.
Yeah, let's do
that. Feel like we should, in fact, but it will sully our palate.
It will.
Yes, but do you want to do it anyway?
Sure.
Because I think you of all people, know how to unsully your palate properly. And we'll just have pretty glasses.
Pretty glasses are nice.
Because we scrounge glasses every which way. Because they're too good to...
Pretty.
Is that a chip?
Pretty glasses.
I will take the chip one. The things that has happened because of COVID, actually, is that last fall we had 50,000 people come to this farm. So our sales were way, way, way up here.
Because people wanted to get out into the countryside.
It was insane. And we also were totally understaffed.
She's looking on the clock right now.
And we blew through bottled cider out level, like people drank everything. I think I have one in my car. I don't know what's where. We just bottled, just so you know. We rarely do this, but a single barrel rye whiskey to die for in a 25-gallon small barrel. We bottled it like 2 days ago.
Wow.
And we're gonna number those bottles. And it's been in wood for 2 years.
In 2 years, wow.
Yeah. And I popped the...
It's kind of like you gotta like barrels or not. Some people like... Yeah. I mean, I love everything.
I tend to be a purist, and I'm very picky, and I do not like, believe it or not, barrel-aged stuff.
Interesting.
Like this.
Okay.
I like Calvados. Well, and I like Pomot.
Yeah.
But I personally think that most of these things are over-oaked and over-bourboned, but we happen to work with a very, very fine distillery, Hill Rock, up in Columbia County, who they have to approve of your cider before they'll sell you a barrel. They will not just sell. Yeah,
cool.
They have to be behind what you're doing. So maybe it'll take too long. So let's keep going.
Okay.
But we'll drink something
okay,
else.
Okay, fine.
If that's okay.
That's fine. That's fine. It's all good. Yeah.
And you're going to have to open this because my wrists aren't good. So
oh, sure.
You have to.
Oh, absolutely. I'd be happy to.
You'll have to squeeze this.
Squeeze
and then it's going to
zhoosh
all over the place.
Is it?
This is a pet now.
Should I? I'll bring these glasses back here. Put them there.
This color, completely
beautiful,
unfiltered, gorgeous.
Okay. So it's okay to open it over here.
And
okay.
And it's a blend of it's got Herrmaster's, Vixen, and Golden Russet.
Ooh,
can't go wrong
with
that.
No, you can't. That's a nice little blend there.
But I think maybe we'll just do it over here.
Okay.
By Pomona.
All right. I have learned to not open stuff by my computer while I'm...
Yeah, exactly.
Believe me, I'm like recording a Zoom conversation with a person.
And you'll you know how to open these.
I do.
But it just takes a little more strength than I have.
No problem.
After all that...
You could have done that.
You know why? Because it's been chilled.
That helps.
You know, when they're straight... You know, when they're warm, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
We do by a lot of pet mat, no sulfites.
Mm-hmm. Hello, New York.
Yeah, hello, New York.
Mm. Tasty.
What do you think?
I love it.
Bone dry.
Yeah, the Harry Masters is just like, ooh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
I
my
like,
new favorite apple.
It's like
when it's got. What
glass.
I love about this cuvée is it's got tannin. It's got bitters. It's got some fruit left. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that I find is the most challenging. And there are people who would drink this cider. This is 0% residual sugar in this case. There are people who would try this cider. You know, this is a cider for people who... You know, this is the kind of cider that I've been making for 30 years, but 30 years ago people were like
what?
Yeah.
I know.
And I
you'd have
some,
to like really get them to do
I
it.
I took some of this cider. We had a meeting with Bomers in 1996. And I gave them some cider like this. We were actually working on a piece of legislation to lower the cider taxes. And Roger Daniels, who was like a muckety muck then, he said to me, "Well, it's very, very good, surprisingly good. It's exactly the kind of cider that we don't think anyone in America will ever drink."
That prophetic was many years
ago. Yeah, prophetic words, though,
yeah,
right?
Right?
And so I'm jumping ahead, but when so the first barrel of cider we made with Lester Funk. And we went to the Cornell Orchard. I wish we had a photo of this. I don't think we do anywhere. And you could fill a 3-pound bag. Back then, I think it was for $1 or something. You know, you could fill.
Right.
And we filled the bags with as many apples as we could. We filled the VW bug literally to the ceiling. It was like one of those photos.
It. Yeah.
And then we took the apples to a very famous old water-powered cider mill that was actually near Leicester. And this was a life, you know, you have these things where it becomes so
pivotal,
so tactile, and each piece of it was magical. It was like a Harry Potter world. It was like you open this portal to another world. And and you're just like, I'm getting goosebumps while I'm telling you. It's so evocative.
But
for
I could
me.
Kind of see you in that world all the time, Elizabeth. I mean, you kind of like dance in that way.
We do, because you have to find the magic.
Yeah.
And and that's a, you know, good skill. I try to
cultivate
you know, we're always looking for the pony, as we say.
Right.
And so we went there, and we this cider mill, which is still there. Steve Seelan and I have talked about this, you know, how to get it back, but it's called the States Cider Mill, and it's in Odessa, New York, the name you do not forget. And it's not functioning, but you could bring your apples in and they would custom press. I think they charge us 25 cents a gallon. Mm. And you would bring your vessel. You know, we had an old clunker, you know, also pickup truck, a friend of ours.
What kind of vessel? Did you just bring the barrel from Leicester?
Of course. 55
gallon barrel.
Yeah, a barrel. That we brought
in the back of a
pickup. They pressed the juice, and it was all the odds and ends. It was the end of the season, so it was all the kind of, you know, windfalls and tree picked and just
blend.
Probably amazing random selection of what you would get kind of in October at the Cornell Orchard,
right?
When they were almost picked out,
right.
They were at the end. So, so we pressed this cider, and you know, Leicester was it was old what they call New England style at Cider Days. And he, you know, was like, you take 2 pounds of raisins or
whatever. Style. Okay.
You just throw them in.
Right. Okay.
And you put the wooden bung in.
And let it
and
go.
You just let it sit.
Yeah.
And we were living off the grid, and we found this all wildly, you know,
perfect.
Romantic.
Poetic.
And, it was the life we wanted to lead.
Sure.
And when we left Ithaca to come to the Hudson Valley, we had this huge all night, you know, we went to Cornell sheep barns and we picked out a lamb, and we had a big lamb roast off the grid. We didn't have any electricity, and we had a real tailgate party. Somebody had, you know, a pickup truck that we could run. Somehow we had a record player that we were running. Somebody had wired it up in this field, and we drank the entire, you know, we kicked the keg.
Right,
the keg.
55 gallons of cider.
Yeah.
It
might have been a little less. The angel share, you know, was...
Yeah, and that was fortified.
Oh my God, it was so good. You know, and that is when you... And I think that cider still, it had some residual sugar. It had, you know, it had gotten kind of a somewhat stuck, you know, fermentation. Mm-hmm. But it was like... Game on, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Game on. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up getting hired in the Hudson Valley to manage a very wonderful Benmarle winery, 75 acres of grapes. Mark Miller, who was an illustrator, who had, with his lovely wife, Dean, she was an architect, they had lived in both Burgundy and Bordeaux. He had gone in the 50s to live the good life in Europe and do illustrations for magazines. He was quite successful. And they had a very happy life. And at a certain point, they had two boys. They decided they should come back to America and let their kids remember they were American. Mm-hmm. And they bought one of the oldest continuously operated vineyards in America, the Kaywood Vineyard in Marlborough, where you're going to spend mm-hmm, the night. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they called it Benmarle. Dean came up with the name, and they built this French-style winery. It was unheard of. They were the first farm winery in New York State. This was in 1976 that he built this, because Mark had a passion for this, and it was all illegal. I mean, this is all this lost history. You couldn't, there were like three frickin' wineries there, you know, if you, yeah. you had to either be huge post-prohibition, whole other mm-hmm, conversation, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was no place. And Mark had this vision that the Hudson Valley could be saved and revolutionized as a place where there were small growers. So he was going to all the apple growers mm-hmm. and say, plant grapes, I will pay you, I will buy them. Mm. We could be one of the great wine regions of the world. Mm. And he was planting a lot of, I ran his vineyard, 75 acres. We'll see you tomorrow, some extraordinary, in the heart of this old, one of the oldest and most established fruit districts. And there were, 50 boats a night that used to go out of Milton with fruit for New mm-hmm. York City. Mm-hmm. Fruit was being sent from the Hudson Valley mm-hmm. in the late 1700s mm-hmm. to England and Scotland and mm-hmm. whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, and Mark had no interest in cider. I kept saying, don't you want to make cider? Oh, no. Mm-hmm. The wine world did not at that moment, you wanted to make Chardonnay or Riesling, or you wanted to work with the great noble grapes. Mm-hmm. Then I'm still quite young, desperately wanted my own farm. So the orchard that we bought in 1984, I was desperately looking for an orchard. Nobody was buying orchards. I didn't have any money, but nobody knew that. And I had a realtor who was like, I'm going to find you an orchard. And she found Breezy Hill Orchard, founding farm of Union Square Grain mm-hmm. Market. And the orchard was just like fucking magic. It had these huge old barns, like I had this list of everything. She kept saying to me, don't you want to look at the house? And I'm like, no, I want to look at the soil map. I mean, I don't care about
that's
the
where
house.
You go. Right,
we'll
right.
deal with it.
Right,
and
right.
so,
love it.
We bought that farm and plunged into New York. And that farm, it was a grower from Long Island who had a farm and was trucking everything down to his Vans Cider Mill in Freeport, Long Island, okay. and all he was growing the fruit up here and taking it down
wow.
there.
Wow. So that told you something right there.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know that when you were buying it, or was that
no,
like an
no,
after
we didn't
story?
Know any of that.
So exact. What did the soil maps tell you? Could you...
So when you're at Cornell, the first thing you do in Pomology 101 is you pretend. It's a tremendous exercise. It goes on for an entire semester that you're buying an orchard. Your dream orchard. I mean, it's so much fun. I wish I could do it again. The Hudson Valley, I think everyone knows, it's that there's something called the lake effect or the ocean effect. You want to be near a body of water. Why do you want to be near a body of water? And this is true for all fruit, temperate zone pomology. You want cold air sinks and warm air rises, right? But bodies of water hold. There's a microclimate. I have two of them mm-hmm. here on this farm that are tremendous. Mm-hmm. Even these mm-hmm. ponds mm-hmm. that we have hold, they never freeze out. Mm-hmm. And it blows my mind that even here, like we're not talking about the ocean,
right?
That it is enough of a lake effect to what, it holds warmth and it becomes a repository for warmth and warm air, and you only need a couple of degrees to save your crops. So that's one piece of it. So you look for a good site. What is a good, well-drained, gravelly loam, 6.5, pH, and that is your primo, more or less. You want hills, you want, you know, the aspect, the way the orchard faces is important. We could argue it's less important for apples than grapes. But anyway, so I had, like, kind of drilled into me that you taste everything, and you never pick until it's ready, right? When Peter and I bought Breezy Hill, that was just in my head, and we immediately ran it that way, and we immediately started getting, we were growing russets and Baldwins and Spitzenberg and five kinds of wine sap and a lot of these old varieties. Ray Sokolov, who was a really well-known food writer, discovered our golden russets and did a wonderful story, and we started getting press. And I started to notice that we were letting our fruit hang much longer, and that a lot of growers are just, and people would say to me, look, you know, and I had another grower who was a friend, and I was like, you know, he picked a certain variety, you know, like probably 2-3 weeks earlier than us. And I said to him, no, we're not going to pick for 3 more weeks. And goes, well, you're going to learn. The minute they have color, I get them off. Anything can happen.
Right,
and they're going off to market, and that's very, very, very true.
It is true. It's one of the biggest, you know.
Yeah, and it's very true in the Hudson Valley where, you know, the weather can be volatile here.
Right.
So
I just, because I want to just you know, help our listeners know that what Elizabeth is talking about is that there's so many climate factors that come involved, and so you are taking a risk leaving it on the tree or on the vine. And if you could push it, you want to kind of push the envelope, but it's a balance, right?
Well, we've experienced it this year of extreme heat and extreme extreme rain.
Yeah,
and so
people,
what we're seeing, and when you get to my other farm, you'll see we actually have peaches and plums that aren't even close to being ready, and they're cracking from too much water.
Right.
Cherries will crack in a heartbeat.
A lot of water this summer.
And yet, you know, we had the heat. So the flavor, we have flavor, we have acid. This is one of these years. Last year, we lost almost all our crop, but in an early spring freeze. Here on this farm, we only took a third of a crop. The Milton farm, we took 100% of a crop because it's on the river.
Okay.
Breezy Hill took about a half a crop. So we took a pretty big hit. And you can see, if you're a fruit grower, you know exactly where the frost line is.
Mm-hmm.
You see it, you live with it in your orchard, so you know. Like, I could show you the line on this farm.
I bet.
Where anything below there, if it's going to, in a cold year. And there, I don't want to do the pomology lesson, but there are things you can do to ameliorate. You've been to Europe, you can have wind machines, you can fly helicopters, you can run irrigation. There are things you can do to
fires,
get a little more fires.
Yeah.
We used to do that. We used to burn tires in the orchard the first few years. Smudge pots.
Right.
You would smudge the orchard.
Yeah.
And pretty nasty.
Yeah, I would say
Like, it's a very
talk about carbon
thick,
footprint.
Oily. Oh, yeah. But, you know,
back
anyway,
then, you didn't know.
It's still done. It's still done in Florida in the orange groves.
Yeah. But of course, neither Elizabeth nor the three farms that she's affiliated with are doing this practice any longer. And let's take this moment now to go over those three orchards and a little bit on how you could get the Hudson Valley Farmhouse Cider brand. The original orchard and farm is known as Breezy Hill Orchard, and that's on the east side of the Hudson River. There is a tasting room there. It's a beautiful site, but it's not open during the pandemic. On the west side of the Hudson River, you have Stone Ridge Orchard that does have a tasting room. It is open currently, and there are select cider dinners that take place there. There's also an outdoor entertainment stage, so keep an eye out on that, and both that and Breezy Hill. Join their Facebook pages. And then the final orchard is in Milton. That is not open to the public, and that's actually where I was able to spend the night and stay with Elizabeth. Just an amazing woman, I mean, literally a walking encyclopedia. I just
I feel for her because she has so much info and it's such at a historical level and revolutionary for food sustainability and all the ways that she has been helping farms. As I was following her down to Milton from Stone Ridge, she kept on pointing out one after another old apple packing houses. And they have a particular style of architecture. Imagine like a shed roof, a low shed roof in a very large building where the trucks could kind of pull up to. So hidden along the ways on all these different back roads are these amazing packing houses, many of them abandoned. And I just kind of look at that and think, oh my goodness, this would be such an awesome place to have a cidery. So that just goes to show you there's always room for more cider in the world. And New York State has it going on, a great New York Cider Association there. And of course, amazing orchards everywhere. So this ends our conversation for now with Elizabeth. I'm sure I'll be following up with her again. An amazing person. Do try her ciders. The cider that we had during this conversation, known as the traditional, I could still taste it. It was that good. And that's just one of her many ciders that she has. You just won't go wrong when you pick up a Hudson Valley Farmhouse cider. You can find all the show notes at ciderchat.com for this here episode 287 with Elizabeth Ryan of Hudson Valley Farmhouse Cider. Before I roll out of here, I want to thank all the folks who are patrons of this here podcast via the Cider Chat Patreon page. Without your support, it'd be really hard to be able to get this podcast out. So not only are you helping out Cider Chat, but you're definitely helping out the industry. And if you haven't become a patron today or donated, well, please consider doing that. Consider it sending a tip to the bartender, but in this case, your friendly cider podcaster. And to do that, you can just go to ciderchat.com. You'll find a donate button there or a link there to the Cider Chat Patreon page. And with that, I'm going to leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. We like palms. We love orchards. And having fun, there is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider. We like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason.
We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!